Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Adam Chowdhury, and today on What in the World, we're asking, how do I become an Olympian? I speak to two young athletes. They explain the sacrifices they've made to make it to the 2024 Summer Games in Paris and what it means for them to compete on the biggest stage in sport. What in the World is the daily podcast that helps you make sense of the world in under 15 minutes. No prior knowledge required. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumhi ekta The Fifth Floor farnak amidi sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. When I was roaming around on the fifth floor earlier this week, I learned that when it comes to the Olympics, there really is something for everyone.
My name is Prudent Nsengiyumba. I am from BBC Great Lakes. When it comes to the Olympic Games, usually football is the most popular game in Rwanda and Burundi. But this year, I think people might be looking forward to fencing. It's a new game in the country, but we have an exciting young woman. And I think the country will be looking forward to seeing how she fares.
I'm Julie Yunyang Lee. I'm from South Korea. One of the most popular Olympic events in South Korea is archery. The South Korean archery team is like a legend, not just in our country, I think probably in the archery world, because they're really, really good at it. We really like the relaxed moment before shooting, so because that really make all of us very focused and quite nervous in a very exciting way.
My name is Luis Barucho, and I work for BBC Brazil. As you know, Brazilians love sports of all kinds. But I would say that this year, Brazilians are hopeful about surfing and skateboarding. We have strong contenders, such as skateboarder Raíssa Leal and surfer Gabriel Medina, both with very impressive track records in international competitions.
Hello, my name is Wan Qingzhang. I'm from the Global China Unit. And one of the most popular Olympics events in China this year is ping pong. No surprise. And this year I'm excited to watch 18-year-old Luo Zhilu compete in the women's sports climbing, which is the combination of bouldering and rope climbing.
It's one thing to be a spectator, but what is it like to cover such a culturally significant and historic sporting event? We are going to find out because today I've invited some of my international colleagues to join me to discuss what the Olympics means to their audiences and to tell us about some of the lesser known stories behind the games. Celestine Coronet from BBC Sports Africa joins us from Nairobi, and I have Puria Joffre from BBC Persian with me in the studio. Both of them will be heading to Paris to cover the games. We also have BBC Uzbek's Firuz Rahimi here with us. He spent the past few years following the incredible story of two sisters from Afghanistan who'll represent their country in the road cycling event, but the road to get there has been anything but smooth. So welcome everyone to the fifth floor. It's great to have you. Puria, I'm going to start with you. Your father, the late Mr. Joffre, who I've known all my life, he covered the Olympics in the 1960 in Rome.
It is 1960, yes, in Rome. It's his actual first duty trip out of the country. And his mom was baking bread for I don't know, a week or so, like for him to take to, little did he know that in Italy there's very good bread. But that's how it was back in the day. You had very little information about the other countries, and the trips took days to plan. And that is the last Olympics that the Iranian wrestling legend Gholam Reza Takhti was competing for Iran, and he got a silver medal there. And this is going to be my second Olympics covering London, obviously, which was kind of hometown for me, but I'm looking forward to see what Paris is like when you go there, because apparently the opening and closing is going to happen on the River Seine. So it's going to be very interesting, and I'm looking forward to it.
And what sports are you going to be focusing on mostly?
In Iran, wrestling is the national sport, and this is what we're focusing the most, and this is where Iran had a healthy dose of its Olympic medals in the past, and hopefully in Paris.
Celestine, the first time you covered the Olympics for the BBC was back in 2020 in Tokyo. Tell me about that experience. How was it?
That was very interesting because while it was my first Olympics for the BBC, it was not my first Olympics. I had been to Rio and London. But then this was a unique Olympics. It was a COVID-impacted Olympics. So we were arriving at a games that used to be a games of culture and color and, you know, all these many fans to empty stadiums, to restrictions of movement. But it was quite exciting to see that the athletes put all that aside and brought their A games when it came to the field of competition. But for me, it was also about finally meeting some of my BBC colleagues that we meet across the screens. You know, it's really interesting that the BBC is this massive organization. People think that we all know each other, but that is not the case. So I honestly felt like I made lifelong friends, you know, when I was covering the Olympic Games with my colleagues.
That's incredible. You didn't meet many fans there, but you met a lot of colleagues. That's a good one.
Yeah.
So Celestine, I know that you are covering a range of different sports in Paris this year. When I look at you, I kind of see you as an encyclopedia of sports rules.
I think, and Puria can attest to this, I think with the more you watch things, the more you learn. But with the traditional sports, you have your rugby, your athletics, your football, your swimming. Because you grow up watching them and probably some of them participating in, it's very easy to have known the rules, to follow the rules. The challenge often comes with the new sports when they introduce them.
And now so, with breaking.
Yes. So, for example, what I did when I heard that breaking was coming to the Olympics, my relationship or my knowledge of breaking was watching hip-hop stars on TV. You know,
even locally, of my cousin dancing in family parties back in the 80s.
I didn't even have that. We didn't have anybody in the family who had an idea of how to do breaking. And so for me, even locally in Kenya, it's not really big. So one of the entrepreneurs in the country said, look, breaking is going to the Olympics. So he organized an invitational international meet. And I called him up and I said, I am coming as a spectator, because I need to learn. I need to find out what is breaking, how does it look like in the Olympics? Because usually when you watch it on TV, it's just people having fun. But now there's a competitive aspect to it. How does one versus one work? Yeah. You know, this is a sport with an MC, a DJ. You're told, come in, you know, dance to the music you've been given. You don't pre-rehearse your moves. Oh, so it was extremely exciting. And it opened my mind to this sport that young people take so seriously, and you got even the sense that you got to identify with them and why they really like it.
Wow, that's so interesting. I really look forward to it now. I had no idea about it, really. So Morocco has two athletes.
We have the B-girl, Fatma Zahra. She's actually the athlete we are going to be featuring in our preview for breaking for BBC Africa. But I think just to touch a bit more on the girl, she's 24, and the significance of her competing is that when she started out breakdancing, her parents didn't support her. You'll find that in Morocco, there tends to be, with some families, a lot of cultural and religious hindrances to girls competing in sports that especially are seen to have a lot of boys, because she would breakdance with boys at the age of 15. And so her mother was not very excited about that and not very happy about that. And her parents initially didn't support her, but they did come around. And what she's keen to show with her participation is that you can still keep your values, but follow your passion. Because, you see, that was some of the fears that her mother, you know, had. You know, you're hanging out with boys socially, culturally, religiously. We really don't do that a lot here in that close proximity as a teenage girl. This is a continent with one of the highest percentage of young people in it. So there's a lot of excitement about the sports that cater and touch on young people.
Celestine was talking about music and about the breakdowns. I was just thinking in my head when Priya was talking about wrestling, you know, because we're on radio. Radio is all about sound and voices, right? The splash of water and running and cyclists, you know, but music was missing probably from the from Olympics, I think. So I think that would be lovely to have a little bit of rhythm, I think, you know. And also the movements, obviously, that you need to see on television.
I would definitely.
So like having said that, then I think, and I wanted to add, yes, there is an Afghan team, and they are residing in Spain, but they will be featuring in a refugee team under that flag. So I can't wait.
Firuz, when it comes to Olympics, we know that it's about sports, but it also sheds light on the political situation across the globe. And you're from Afghanistan. This whole Olympics is putting the whole political situation in Afghanistan in the spotlight. Tell us more about it a little.
It is, especially now, because by the time the Olympics will finish, it will be the Taliban's third anniversary in power. For that very reason, there is a lot of debate whether Afghanistan will be represented with athletes in Paris Olympics. Although, having said that, even in the past 20 years, when the Afghans, they, for the first time, they won in a silver medal in Taekwondo, it's still, even then, without their Taliban, it was about all political representation because, you know, with the war in Afghanistan, with the international troops involvement in Afghanistan, all that. But now it's much more under spotlight. And that's why International Olympic Committee has decided to select a team which is gender equal. So there will be three female athletes and three male athletes. So five of the athletes left their country since the Taliban took over and scattered around the world, like a lot of other Afghans that happened when the Taliban came into the power. And then there's one Afghan who's coming from Afghanistan and he's training at the moment. Then Olympic Committee said no invitation. They did not extend invitation to Taliban. So they're not be participations of officials from Afghanistan. But for that reason, then also Taliban said they will not recognize the Afghan nominees, especially girls. You know, we all associate the sports bodies to be kind of, you know, away from politics. But in that very case, they tried to send a signal or message to Taliban saying, this is a team, it's a gender equal team, and that's how Afghanistan should look like.
And what are they participating in?
So one male sports person will be coming from Afghanistan on judo and two other male who lives outside Afghanistan will be on a sprinters and one will be on swimming. And then Kimia Yusufi, who were the flag bearer in Tokyo Olympics, who she is right now, lives in Australia, has been selected. And then the two sisters, which I've been following their story, Fariba and Yulduz Hashimi, they are in Swiss. They are cyclists, so they will be representing Afghanistan.
One thing which came up and which can be very interesting, like for anyone who's following the Olympics, is the question of representation. And it's not only the flag, it's not only the national anthem, it's the person. Does that person represent my country? And sometimes it can go a lot broader than that. You know, even if there are Iranians in the refugee team, okay, there's that matter of nationality and nationalism and the politics, but then again, every single one of them, they represent something, you know? Like, so there's a woman in Iran, let's say, who doesn't like to compete with hijab, and she sees herself in that other woman who's competing without hijab. They can relate to them, and that's what makes the games interesting.
Now, Firuz, you've been following the journey of these two Afghan sisters who are part of the cyclist team, and you went to Italy to visit them, and I remember we covered it here on the Fifth Floor as well. But you recently went to Switzerland.
Yes, I did.
So tell us about them. What's their story?
Fariba and Yulduz, they were two cyclists, as with other groups of male and female cyclists, who left Afghanistan when Taliban took over, and they were in one of the flights that evacuated them, and five of them were evacuated to Italy, and there were some cyclists who were evacuated to Swiss, and some were to Canada, you know, so because that was a desperation to get out of Afghanistan, kind of, especially for these athletes. So now the journey for the sisters, they started in a very remote part of Afghanistan, in northern Afghanistan, very conservative city. And it was fascinating how the two sisters started. And she told, they told me, the both sisters, they had to wear disguises to, for the first time, when they went out to cycle, and then when they, so they attended a race, and they somehow, you know, there was a cyclist federation had was formed much more easily, kind of, you know, for women to join in Kabul because it's a capital or other big cities. But remote parts of Afghanistan is purely out of your own passion, because growing up, I've never seen a woman cycle. In northern Afghanistan, a place where I am.
Wow.
And so it's fascinating for me. You know, I think it's just when they were telling me, when they were just cycling on the streets and people were throwing things at them, or so, but they did not give up. And that's when I spoke to them. They're quite resilient at the very young age, and then to battling up your way. And then evidently they were very good at what they were doing. And so finally they were competed in the races in capital Kabul and other places. Having said that, when we say that Afghanistan had a cycling team, it might look fancy, but it is a bicycle, a very basic one, with a less, you know, less kind of resources available to them. Yeah. And when I met them back in Italy, despite all the challenges, is when you leave your home, you know, adopting to the new country, adopting the new language, away from your families and all those things, is very difficult. So they were lucky to have, you know, an Italian trainer then, and they kind of focused. And their first word to me was, "This is." They felt like they've just started cycling.
Aww.
So, you know,
so
in a kind
inspiring.
Of exactly, and they went on, and then even their trainer was just thinking, out of all those female athletes, you know, they would be lucky to make up to the world stage. But luckily for these two sisters, Freiba and Yulduz, they were part of this Italian team, and they really competed in different countries over this 3 years, starting from Thailand all the way to Kazakhstan, to Dushanbe, to Istanbul. So then second year in Europe, they were part of this Swiss-based team. And then finally, they are part of the International Cycling Federation's Women Development Team, which they've got more resources now. They're based in Aigle, and they have got trainers, and they are training. And they have come far, kind of, you know, since I met them. Because I was trying to find out in terms of, you know, how they feel. And it still, it did not feel real for them. One thing was very evident for me. For them to compete under the Afghan flag was much more important for them. They wanted to represent Afghanistan, and they wanted to go under that last Afghan government's national flag to showcase the how far an Afghan woman can come.
Really, really remarkable.
It's one of their biggest achievements, I think.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Adam Chowdhury, and today on What in the World, we're asking, how do I become an Olympian? I speak to two young athletes. They explain the sacrifices they've made to make it to the 2024 Summer Games in Paris, and what it means for them to compete on the biggest stage in sport. What in the World is the daily podcast that helps you make sense of the world in under 15 minutes. No prior knowledge required. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I'm Farhana Kamidi, and in this episode of The Fifth Floor, we are hearing about what's it like to report on the Olympic Games. Celestine, the International Olympics Committee has announced that the Paris Olympics is going to be the first gender-equal Games. First of all, what does that mean when they say that? And then what does this look like from an African perspective?
Gender parity for the Olympics here means that there will be the equal number of women participating in the field of play. You have, for example, I think in the in the Olympics in the 80s, it was about 23%. So now they're able to say, look, men and women, 50-50. And that is such a milestone, especially when you're trying to get more women into sport, because it shows that the IOC is trying to push, or international federations, to have more women competing. But in terms of the reality, for example, for Africa, gender parity really is something that is so far away in terms of being achieved. If you look at most of the African countries, I would mention maybe Mauritius, Rwanda, South Africa, are the only ones with very good gender parity scorecards. And we're talking across all walks of life. And so for Africa, gender parity really doesn't mean much. you know, it feels like this global token that is far for them to reach, because a lot of women are still, there's still cultural practices, there's religious practices that stop women from getting into sport. So it has not been realized for Africa, if I can say it like that. It has not been realized for Africa. And one athlete that we've spoken to and has been very vocal about, you know, just getting more women into sport is a taekwondo athlete for Lesotho. She will be competing in the Olympics. She's called Michelle Tao, and she's a model as well. She's an artist, and she's a big women rights campaigner. And she says there's a lot more that's needed to be done on the African continent from where she comes from in terms of learning and, you know, making people who run the sport appreciate the development of women and getting more women into sport at grassroots level. You see, that is where the disparity comes in. When you have women, sometimes women getting into sport only at high school because they've finally gone to a high school where they can, you know, they can participate in something they like, or they see something they like. Back home, it is not available for them. And so this is a story we will be following. We'll be looking at the Africans competing, speaking to people like Kirsty Coventry. She's an IOC member. She was multiple medalist for Zimbabwe. She's a minister for sport in Zimbabwe. You know, just talking about what will it take for Africa to be able to also realize these benefits of, you know, a movement like this, you know, at that global level. But it trickled down all the way to countries like the Central African Republic, which only have one participant and who is male, you know. So this is now some of the things we will be, breaking down when we are covering the Olympics for our African audience.
And I think that resonates with a lot of different parts of the world, because gender parity is still something that hasn't been realized in many different parts of the world, as we were talking about Iran and Afghanistan as well. So historically in Kenya, what are some of the big disciplines that you follow and are big events in the Olympics for the country?
For us, it's always track and field. Mm. And when I say track and field, it's not the whole, both the field events and the track events. It's usually mainly the middle and the long distance athletics, you know, from our 800 meters all the way up to the marathon. So Kenyans are expecting to rip medals in those events. And, you know, for us, these are things that we grew up. For example, I come from the region where athletes come from. It's northwest of the country. And these athletes, I grew up literally watching them running outside like whenever we'd go on holiday to my grandmother's. You watch them in the morning running, and then you ask,
neighbors,
"Oh, what's happening
with the marathon runner?"
I am neighbors. I am neighbors.
Yes, Eliud Kipchoge.
I am neighbors with Eliud Kipchoge. You know, who's going for a third marathon. He wants to be the first man to win three Olympic gold medals in the marathon. And so for someone like me, these things were it was second nature. I was so used to them. And so when I came to covering them, when I was told, oh, let's do a story about, for example, the village where most Kenyan runners come from. It's called Iten, and it's very popular. A lot of them go to train there. And I remember the very first time I was asked to do that story, I said, but everybody knows about that. Then I realized, oh, sorry, switch my mind back. I'm a journalist now. I'm not, I'm not Celestine from the village who knows all these things. I have to tell the world about these things.
Celestine, is this something that you all watch together? Like you go to a bar or a cafe and watch your favorite runner? Yeah.
Do you know how around the world, when a national team is playing in either the Euros final or playing in, you know, in the World Cup, and everybody's in a bar. You know, if you're not in the stadium, you're in a bar or somewhere where you're able to watch with your friends. In the town I come from, when Eliud Kipchoge was running to try and become the first man to run the marathon in under 2 hours, the streets were locked. There was because they put big screens in the town, all over the town. You couldn't drive into the town. It was locked. When you have major marathons, your London marathons, your Chicago marathons, you know, you have bars are full, and these most of these towns, you'll find that people even come out on the streets to watch on the big screen. That is how much people follow, distance running in Kenya.
And I'm just curious, do you run yourself?
Oh, hi. No, I don't run. And I was we were in a briefing with Poria, and I remember
we were planning to do that in Paris.
Yes.
I think it's an amazing feeling. I don't think, okay, you want to see the 100 meters, you want to see the swimming, yeah, you want to see the weightlifting, but I don't think if there's any discipline but marathon, which is so close to the Olympics, both of them coming from Greece with such a history, and it should be an amazing feeling, like when you're watching that and you know someone who's gonna win it. And can I just add something? Mm-hmm. You know, there are some amateur runners doing the marathon, but nobody's there by accident. If you're a US president, you're always going to be a US president. If you win a gold medal, you're always going to be like a gold medalist. But if you take part in the Olympics, you're always going to be an Olympian.
I think that's what I wanted to. So one thing was, especially when it came about the refugee team and the same thing with Afghanistan, the first time when you talk about these things, usually the approach is, oh, they've been like given a wild card kind of thing. And I think you're very right, you know, that even if the wild card is given, even if an opportunity is presented to you, it does not mean they just bring you to just, let's say in this case, upset Taliban. No.
Yeah. Yeah, you kind of forget that every single person who's there, they've put like kind of every day, every hour of the last 4 years to be there.
Okay, so now a question for all of you passionate reporters. Who are you looking forward to seeing compete?
My mind is already made.
Tell me.
I'll be watching the Yıldız and Fariba. I might be biased in this. And also Afghan Taekwondo, he's going to compete in the refugee team, but he's residing in Britain at the moment. And I think, yes.
Puria, who are you looking forward to see?
I'm going to go back to football, but not men's, women's. The difference between men's and women's football is that For the women's football, you have the actual proper teams, like all the professionals are there, and like it's like another edition of the World Cup. So it's going to be big, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see the fans back after we didn't have them during COVID, and it's going to be very much fun.
Celestine, who do you have your eyes on?
It's going to be a Kenyan, no surprise. But it's because of what she represents, Faith Kipyegon, the 1500 meter world record holder. And, you know, she's seeking a third consecutive Olympic title in the 1500 meters. And she's also she's going to run the 5000 meters and trying to win a gold as well in the 5000 meters. She recently broke her own world record in the 1500 meters. But like Puria, I am looking forward to the return of fans. The Olympics. What color it will bring.
You guys are going to have fun in Paris, I bet. So Celestine Karaney, Firuz Rahimi and Puria Joffre, thank you all for your passionate discussion here on The Fifth Floor. And that's all from me, Farhanak Amidi, and the rest of The Fifth Floor team. I'm Farhanak Amidi, and The Fifth Floor team was Hannah Dean and Caroline Ferguson. You've been listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Adam Chowdhury, and today on What in the World, we're asking, how do I become an Olympian? I speak to two young athletes. They explain the sacrifices they've made to make it to the 2024 Summer Games in Paris, and what it means for them to compete on the biggest stage in sport. What in the World is the daily podcast that helps you make sense of the world in under 15 minutes. No prior knowledge required. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.